In Roseville, Minnesota today, continuing with hour number six, the sixth and final hour of Ethics for Fresh Air 2011. We're going to finish talking about some of the advertising type issues and then kind of some miscellaneous items that are covered by the rule. Again, we're in Roseville today is April 26th, and we're recording this for video replay and possibly a podcast, and for purposes of the podcast, I'll intersperse a couple of code words here. So for the podcast listeners, please record those code words to get your certificate of attendance. Well, talking about firm names and letterheads, and this is also an area where the states diverge just a little bit, or quite a bit. Minnesota and Wisconsin have pretty much adopted the ABA model rules, whereas Iowa stuck with some of its older rules. So we will talk about both of those. Once again, a lot of these advertising type issues, the Iowa Supreme Court just appointed a committee to look into amending these rules to report back by the end of the year. So chances are when we do Iowa Ethics Refresher 2012, we'll be looking at a new set of rules on most of these advertising issues. But turning first to Minnesota and Wisconsin, talking about firm names and letterheads. Firm names, first of all, they can't be false or misleading. They have to be comply with Rule 7.1. And it is permissible to use a trade name, not your actual name, not James Smith, attorney at law, but so-and-so law office using some kind of trade name. But there are some restrictions on that. First of all, the last one here, you can't violate Rule 7.1, so it can't be false or misleading. You can't say call yourself the Harvard educated law firm unless you were actually educated at Harvard. So as with everything, that rule applies. You can't be false and misleading. You can't imply a connection with a government agency or a public or charitable organization. That's one where you have to kind of watch out a little bit if you use geographic names. So if you call yourself Twin City Bankruptcy Attorneys, that's probably okay because there is no government agency with a name similar to Twin City Bankruptcy Attorneys or anything like that. So that's probably okay. But if you start calling yourself Roseville City Attorneys, well, that might run into some problems because there is another office called the Roseville City Attorney and you're not them. Would imply a connection with them. So using geographic names, you have to kind of watch out for it because that can run into problems with making it sound like you're connected with the government of that geographic region. So if you're if you're identifying yourself as being part of town, the Como Park lawyers or North End attorneys or Northern Suburb attorneys or something, that's probably okay. But when you pick the name of a city or county, you have to be careful. And you can't imply that you're connected with any kind of public or charitable legal services organization. That's another one that runs into problems maybe with geographic names. So if you call yourself Southern Minnesota Legal Services, well, that might sound like I can't think of the exact name. Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, I think, is a charitable legal services organization. So you have to watch out for that. And in fact, even the word legal services might run into problems. So maybe law office would be better. So you have to keep that in mind if you decide to use any kind of a trade name. Typically, though most lawyers use their name or the name of the lawyers in the firm, that's what they put on the door. Smith and Jones or Smith Law Firm or whatever. That can potentially run into problems if some of those lawyers are admitted in more than one jurisdiction. Smith is embedded in Minnesota, Jones is embedded in Wisconsin. Well, the rule says you can use the name Smith and Jones at both your Minnesota and your Wisconsin office, if you really are operating as a partnership. But on the letterhead, you have to identify the lawyers and any jurisdictional limitations. So when you when you get these letters from some of these big firms where their letterhead takes up over half the sheet, we get to list all the lawyers, but they also have to list the jurisdictional limitations. So Smith, Jones, Smith, they have a little asterisk, admitted only in Minnesota, not admitted in Wisconsin, or however they want to word it. The name of a lawyer holding public office shall not be used during any substantial period in when he is not actively and regularly practicing with the firm. So if you're elected to the state legislature, in theory anyway, the legislature is a part-time job, so you can continue to practice law when you're serving in the legislature, and your name can be on the firm, or there are many other part-time public positions, school board or whatever. It's not a full-time job, and you're certainly free to continue using your name. If your name is Obama and you get elected president, the firm that you were practicing with probably can't continue to use the name Obama in the firm because you're not actively and regularly practicing with the firm. It's during any substantial period, so they kind of leave a little gap in there, give you some time to print up your new letterhead after you go to Washington. And lawyers may state or imply that they practice as a partnership or other organization only if that is true. So if you have some kind of office sharing arrangement, for example, that's not truly a partnership, Smith and Jones share an office, maybe share a secretary or something, but they have their own practices. They're not operating as a partnership. They probably can't use the name Smith and Jones because that kind of implies that it's a partnership. So they would have to print up their own letterhead. So anyway, those are the only rules in Minnesota and Wisconsin governing firm names and letterhead. And these are not too restrictive. You basically just can't be misleading about things, and there are a couple of specific requirements. Iowa, on the other hand, does go in for quite a bit more restrictions. And not only their firm names, they talk about the sign on the door. There are some pretty specific restrictions on what your sign can look like in Iowa. And as always, everything connected with attorney communications in Iowa must be dignified. So first of all, your sign must be dignified. And of course, it can't be false or misleading, just like in the other states. The rule specifically says that rule 7.1, talking about false or misleading information, still applies in addition to these rules. But once again, Iowa doesn't come out and prohibit things. They just list a few things that you are allowed to do. And they first of all talk about business cards. A lawyer may do any of the following if they are in a dignified form. Well, he can have a professional card identifying him by name and as a lawyer. So he can give your name. He can say you're a lawyer. He can give your name, address, phone number, the name of your firm, and the information permitted by Rule 7.4. And once again, that's pretty specific way that you can talk about what you specialize in. That can be on the card. So you have to look at that rule for the exact wording, but specializing in Iowa admiralty law, you can print that on your card if you follow Rule 7.4. And you can also give the names other members and associates of the firm. And I don't know exactly what this last sentence means. Such cards may be used for identification. I guess what they're saying is you're really not supposed to, it would be undignified if you use them for advertising. They're used for identification. You know, allow me to introduce myself. I am Mr. Lawyer. So that's what can go in your business cards. A few years ago, I had some business cards printed up with a calendar on the back. And they were very popular. It doesn't say anything in this rule about having a calendar in your business card. I don't know if that would be permissible in Iowa.
Podcast code word is calendar. The first podcast code word is calendar.
You can have a brief professional announcement card. So if something interesting happens in your firm, you are allowed to send out cards. So if you have a change of address or a change of name, change of firm name, that kind of information, I believe new lawyers coming into your firm, that sort of thing, a professional announcement. Those are permitted. Same change of association. That would be new attorneys coming into your firm, or Mr. So-and-so is retiring, or something like that. So you can print up some of these announcements saying, the law firm of Smith and Jones is pleased to announce that Ms. Johnson is joining the firm, and that sort of thing. But you can't just mail it to anybody. You can't just mail it to everybody in town. You can mail it to other lawyers. There's no restriction on that. You can send it to your clients. You can send it to your former clients. You can send it to your personal friends and to your relatives. I don't think identify personal friends. That's probably a little bit wider open definition, I would think, of personal friends. So maybe you can send it to all your Facebook friends, whereas you might not be able to call them up on the phone and solicit their business. You can't include biographical data on there, but there are a couple of exceptions stated in the rule, but you can't include the long form of your biography. It may not state the nature of the practice except as permitted by Rule 7.4. So once again, if it says that Ms. Jones, your new associate, will be doing bankruptcy cases or something to that effect, that sounds kind of innocuous, but you have to look back at that Rule 7.4 and make sure that you're wording it the way that it needs to be worded, because, again, you can't just use any word or phrase to describe a particular area of law. You have to use ones on that list. You can't send it to everybody in town, but some announcements you can print in the newspaper. A dignified announcement of a change of location, addition of new attorneys, or change of the firm name can be published in newspapers for no more than 4 weeks. If you hired a new associate, you can say, you can put an ad in the paper, the law firm of Hanson Jones is pleased to announce that Ms. Johnson is joining the firm. You can print that in the newspaper, but only for 4 weeks. So it's pretty restrictive on what these announcements can be. Now, moving on, it says that you are allowed to put up a sign in front of your office you want the UPS driver to be able to find you, so they recognize that you do need a sign. But you're allowed to put a sign near your door and in the building directory. So when you come into the lobby by the elevator, there's these directories. Under S, we can say that Smith and Jones are on the 13th floor or whatever. But once again, if that sign, which uh, I think probably, I'm not sure if the rule says it, but it probably better be dignified. Even there, those area of practice restrictions are still in effect. Finally, letterhead. Your letterhead, kind of like the business card, it can say your name, it can say you're a lawyer, your address, phone number, name of the firm, name of other attorneys in the firm, and once again that practice area, practice limited to bankruptcy or whatever words are permitted by Rule 7.4. Here's one where they actually go a little bit further than Minnesota does specifically. First of all, you enlist the other lawyers of the firm, including your deceased and retired members. I'm not sure, but I believe there's a law firm in Illinois that still has the name Lincoln on the door. And that's Abe Lincoln. So he's a retired member of the predecessor firm, so they still have his name on the letterhead. And that would be permissible in Iowa as well. A lawyer who has a continuing relationship and is not a partner or associate of the firm, can be designated of counsel. There's also an Iowa restriction on how the word general counsel can be used on a corporation's letterhead. So you are the general counsel for, the Acme Insurance Company of Des Moines or whatever. That company has its own letterhead, obviously, and you probably want some printed. But your name can only be printed on their letterhead if you devote a substantial amount of your professional time to that particular client. So, for example, if you're employed by a company, you get a regular paycheck as their general counsel, that is probably okay for you to appear on their letterhead. But on the other hand, if you just drafted the corporate paperwork for a company, and maybe you are their secretary or their general counsel, they probably can't print on their letterhead, or you shouldn't let them print on their letterhead, the Acme Widget Company, John Smith General Counsel. That should be limited to cases where you devote a substantial portion of your professional time to that particular client. Finally, the letterhead of a firm, they give the names and dates of predecessor firms. So, Smith and Jones, you can put below that, formerly Jones and Johnson, 1981 to 1985. You can identify the predecessor firm and give the dates that that predecessor firm was in existence. Once again, just like the other two states, if a firm has offices in more than one state, they are allowed to use the same name in all of those states, even if some of the members are not admitted everywhere. There has to indicate somewhere on the letterhead what that jurisdictional limitation is. So, Smith and Jones, and a little asterisk by Joe in the name, saying not admitted in Iowa. The same restriction copied from the model rule that a lawyer holding public office can't use his name unless for any substantial time that he's not actively and regularly practicing with that firm. Again, if you're elected to the school board or the state legislature and you still continue to practice law, you can be on there. But if you're elected governor and you retire from the day-to-day practice of law while you serve as governor, then within a less than a substantial period of time, you have to have some new letterhead printed up with the correct names. In Minnesota and Wisconsin, the rule about trade names started out by saying you can use a trade name subject to the following restrictions. In Iowa, it's the other way around. The general rule is that you are not allowed to use a trade name or a name that is leading as to the identity of the lawyers in the firm. So your firm name basically has to identify the lawyers who are the members of the firm. So there can't be a law firm called Des Moines DWI Attorneys or Hawkeye Law or something. You can't use a trade name in Iowa, subject to a couple of restrictions. First of all, if you really are a professional corporation or an LLP or any of those things that, where letters go after the name of the firm, you're allowed to use those. If it's otherwise lawful, so you have to really be the kind of entity that you're holding yourself out to be. And once again, a firm may continue to use the name of deceased or retired members of the firm or predecessor firm. So if Abe Lincoln had come from Iowa, there could still be a Lincoln Law Firm somewhere in Iowa. Because you can, when I took the bar review course for this, I remember the instructor made me worthy of, dead is okay. So you can put the names of dead lawyers on there. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the advertising types of things. A couple of rules that kind of a little bit of a continuation of that. I don't know exactly why Minnesota doesn't have a rule 7.6, but I suspect I would kind of advise you, even if you're in Minnesota, kind of maybe don't do this because there might be some other rules that you would run afoul. But rule 7.6 only exists in Iowa and Wisconsin. For whatever reason, Minnesota does not adopt this. But like I say, I think it's covered elsewhere in the rules, or probably elsewhere in the state statutes. But it's kind of common sense, so don't do this, even in Minnesota. A lawyer or law firm shall not accept a government legal engagement or an appointment by a judge if he or she makes a political contribution or solicits contributions for the purpose of being considered. Maybe they didn't put it in there because that's maybe a little bit unenforceable. They're hard to figure out what your purpose was. So I guess if you go in and tell the governor governor you want to be appointed the railroad commissioner or something. So you can go in and tell the governor, governor, here's a campaign contribution. I'm giving this contribution for the purpose of being considered for this this appointment. In Iowa and Wisconsin, that's a violation of the rules. In fact, that's kind of what Governor Blagojevich is in trouble for, because presumably that's what he was accused of accepting contributions like that for the purpose of saying, if you can contribute this, so I'll consider you for this appointment. So apparently the feds seem to think that that's a violation of federal law, but in Iowa and Wisconsin, it's also a violation of the rules of professional conduct. But once again, for whatever reason, Minnesota did not adopt that identical rule. Now, it does not say, though, that if you make a donation to Smith for judge, and a year later Judge Smith appoints you to represent some person, and you get paid public funds for doing that. It does not say that you can never accept an appointment if you gave a campaign contribution, but it does say that you can't do it for that purpose. Now that, depending on the size of the contribution, you might want to avoid those kinds of situations because it might look like you're doing that, but it has to be for the purpose of doing it. If I give $20 to the governor for his reelection campaign, and the next year he appoints me judge, I guess that kind of makes sense because I probably wasn't giving that $20 contribution for the purpose of being considered. But it's something to be careful and watch out for. Okay, Iowa has a couple more rules about talking to potential, not only clients, but potential people who need attorneys. Basically, you can't recommend yourself to somebody else unless you fit within all those other rules. So you cannot say, the general rule is that you're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to say, I think you should hire me as your attorney, or I think you should let me represent you, or your partner, or your associate, anybody in your firm. The general rule is you're not allowed to say that to anybody, and there are some exceptions to that. But in general, you're not allowed to recommend yourself for employment. Now, first of all, there are some exceptions to that that we already covered. In Rule 7.2, there is a limited amount of advertising that lawyers are allowed to do. And Rule 7.3, talking about contacting prospective clients. There were some very specific conditions on that. But unless you fit within any of those specific rules, the general rule is that you're prohibited from contacting people and recommending yourself or other members of your office for professional employment. And you can't pay somebody else to recommend you. There's a few limited exceptions. If you are engaging in advertising that is permitted under Rule 7.2, those pretty restrictive advertising rules, you're allowed to pay for it. I guess that would be kind of, the newspaper sends the bill, and say, oh, I'm sorry, I've been allowed to pay you. Yes, you are. A bar association referral service, well, that's exactly what they do. Somebody calls up and says, I need a bankruptcy attorney and counsel bluffs. And you say, call us for so-and-so. So you're allowed to pay that, the normal charges for that. And you're allowed to buy a law practice subject to the rule governing that. Because that's part of what you're doing when you're buying a law practice. Is you're paying for the other guy to say, I'm retired, call the new guy. But you're allowed to do that as long as you comply with the other parts of the rule. And in general, you're not allowed to request any kind of recommendation other than, again, it's governed by the advertising rules. So not only are you not allowed to pay for them, but you're not allowed to ask people to refer you unless it fits under one of these four exceptions. First of all, the Bar Association Referral Service. The Story County Bar Association, they'll say, call attorney so-and-so. You can be advertised in a directory listing of Iowa lawyers. So the Bar Association basically publishes a directory of attorneys saying that these practice bankruptcy, these practice trust and estates, these do DWI. They can have a directory like that. You can cooperate with certain legal services activities. So this is, look at the rule for the specifics on that. But it's basically, you're allowed a legal services for low-income people kind of organization is allowed to refer things to private attorneys, but there are some conditions that apply to that. And once again, condition number four kind of covers that same situation. But very limited on who you can request a recommendation from. You have to fit under one of those four categories. In fact, Iowa even goes a little bit further. Not only can you not recommend yourself, but there are even restrictions on you have to get a lawyer. And those restrictions are covered in Iowa Rule 7.8. And so basically what the rule is there is you can, if I'm standing here and I see somebody slip and fall through the window because of a dangerous condition, yes, I'm allowed to tell them, you really ought to sue because they were negligent and, you really ought to talk to a lawyer. But you can't say, and that lawyer should be me. Because in Iowa, a lawyer who has given unsolicited advice in person or by telephone to a layperson may not accept employment resulting from that advice. So you are allowed to tell people, you really ought to talk to a lawyer, but you cannot accept that employment. You can, they can go to any other lawyer, but not to you, because you have given them unsolicited advice resulting from that advice. So now, 5 years, that doesn't bar them from life, but it's resulting from that advice. You want to talk to a lawyer about that slip and fall. They can't come to you for the slip and fall. But there are a couple of exceptions to that. First of all, they close friends. So when you're, as Ben Hartman would say, close personal friends. You can tell them, but probably not your Facebook friends. Your 9,000 Facebook friends. You should sue. By the way, I just happened to, here's my number. A relative, an existing client, or a former client. So if your former client, you drafted a will for him last year, and you read in the paper that he just won the lottery, and so you can call him and say, you really ought to talk to a lawyer about updating your will. Now you have to be careful when you continue on and say, so give me a call. But you could accept the employment if he offers it. Advice given, another exception is advice given for participation in activities designed to educate laypersons about the law if it's conducted by a nonprofit organization, and there are some restrictions on that. So you are at the law day clinic at the mall, and people come in and they have a landlord-tenant question, you answer the question, and you tell them you should talk to a lawyer about this. And lo and behold, on Monday they call you up, and you're the lawyer they call. Well, you're allowed to take that probably as long as it fits the conditions here, because it was that education thing that was conducted by certain nonprofit organizations. And finally, there's an exception to that if the lawyer is recommended, furnished, or paid by certain legal services organizations. So if you see the person slip and fall, and you happen to work for the the pro bono legal service corporation or whatever, then you would probably be okay under that. Now a lawyer, another kind of big exception to that, or bigger than those very narrow exceptions, is that they recognize that a lawyer may write or speak publicly on legal topics, and that does not affect your right to accept employment. So, for example, if you write a bona fide book on, how to everybody needs a will, is the title of your book, and you talk about wills, and it's not done for the purposes of soliciting employment, like maybe that hapless guy we talked about who wrote the DWI book. So you just still have to watch out there. But you can't write about that, and just because somebody bought your book doesn't mean that they can't call you. And also speaking publicly. So for example, a church or community organization invites you in to talk about wills or healthcare directives or something, when you speak about it, not with the aim of necessarily soliciting clients, but you talk about it and you hold yourself out as an expert. Well, one of those people calls you wanting advice, even if it results from what you said at your speech, that's probably okay. But the big exception there is those activities must not emphasize the lawyer's own expertise or reputation. So if you're speaking to the to a church group about drafting wills, and you talk about what's contained in a will, what's the effect of a will, how does the will work, what happens if you don't have a will, that's okay. But if you start talking about your own expertise and talking about how good your wills are, well, then it starts sounding like that or that thing. So that provision is in there kind of to make sure that it's really bona fide public speaking, not just a thinly veiled cover for advertising. Here's another exception for certain class action situations. If you're allowed to, if you are the lawyer, because in class action things, a lot of times you're required to send out notice to certain people. You see those ads on the back of magazines that nobody reads, full of fine print, notifying claimants of a potential class action. Well, if one of those people calls you up and says, well, I want you to represent me on this, you can take that, but you can't seek it out. If you're giving a notice that's required by the court, you can still take it from those people. So once again, that's just an Iowa rule, and Minnesota and Wisconsin do not have a corresponding version of that. Those first general rules about communications with the public and advertising and communicating with potential clients still apply, but Iowa has that section in that's just a little bit more, or quite a bit more restrictive than the other two states. Well, that kind of wraps up advertising. Now we move into Rule 8, which is kind of the miscellaneous rules. Things are kind of classed. Rule 1 talks about your relationship with your client, for example. I think Rule 2 talks about relationship with the court and other people. Well, they're kind of categorized, but Rule 8 is kind of the miscellaneous things that didn't fit anywhere else. Rule 8.1 talks about bar admissions, kind of the jurisdictional rules. Lawyers are bound by the rules, but also people applying for admission to the bar are bound by certain things. On your bar application, or in connection with a disciplinary matter, so like that guy who wrote the book on DWI got into some trouble. He probably wouldn't have gotten disbarred just for advertising his book. But what he got in trouble for was when the regulatory people called him up. He kind of implied that he had no connection with the publisher. In fact, he did. So at any time you make in connection with any kind of disciplinary matter, you can't knowingly make a false statement of material fact, fail to disclose a fact necessary to correct the misapprehension that the person knows has arisen. So maybe that's where that guy got into trouble. But maybe it was a separate entity, but he failed to disclose the fact necessary to correct the misapprehension. The publisher printed that out, and he failed to disclose the fact. Oh, and the publisher shares an office with me. So you have to disclose things in, connection with a disciplinary matter or a bar application, and knowingly fail to respond to a lawful demand for information. So if you, I hope you never do, but if you get a letter from the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, you have to, if they ask you for information, you have to comply with that. But once again, the rule makes clear, though, that if that information is confidential under Rule 1.6, you're not required to disclose that information. So those client confidentiality rules trump even this. Okay, Rule 8.2, talk nice about judges and candidates for judicial office. A lawyer shall not knowingly or recklessly make a false statement concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge, adjudicatory official, public legal officer, or candidate for judicial or legal office. So when you lose your case and you're coming out of court, don't say, Judge so-and-so is a crook, unless he really is a crook. You don't want to knowingly or even recklessly say anything false about judges' qualifications or integrity. And that also applies to candidates for judicial office. So if you're the judge and somebody's running against you, you're not allowed to say that other guy is a crook unless he really is. So you have to be, even though the rules on what's allowed in judicial campaigns have opened up quite a bit, that regulation is still in place in all of our three states. If you are running for judge, then from the time you start your campaign, you are at that point, in addition to being bound by these rules, you're also bound by the Code of Judicial Conduct. So there's a separate set of rules governing the conduct of judges, and in Minnesota anyway, all judges are lawyers, so they're also governed by this set of rules. But if you run for judge, if you're a candidate for judge in a judicial election, then you have to comply with the rules of judicial conduct during the campaign, whether or not you're elected, and then. If you don't follow them, that's the
second and final podcast code word is clock. The second podcast code word is clock, C-L-O-C-K.
Judge, keep that in mind. The Code of Judicial Conduct is not covered today, so you have to find that. It's online. You can read it. And it tells you the things that you're allowed and not allowed to do. Don't defame the judges and... if you're running for judge, get a hold of that copy of those rules first. Okay, reporting misconduct. You have a duty to rat on your friends, as I've heard it put. A lawyer who knows that another lawyer has violated these rules shall inform the appropriate authority. You come in here and you're telling me about, I just embezzled some money from a client today. Well, I would have to report that. So don't say that. There's an exception to that, which we'll get to in a minute. A lawyer that if you know that a judge has violated the rules of judicial conduct, then you're required to inform the appropriate authority. So. If you saw Judge so-and-so take a bribe, not only is he in trouble, but you are in trouble if you fail to report that. Because you could potentially, if you just filed a small bribe, I'll just look the other way. Well, no, if you know that he's engaged in that violation of his rules, then you are required to turn him into the, whatever the name of the board is, Board of Judicial Standards or something. However, there is an exception. If the information is confidential, then you don't have to breach your confidentiality in order to disclose it. So, for example, if If another lawyer comes into your office and says, you know, I'm in trouble. I've been, you know, dipping into my trust accounts, and I'm gonna, you know, be in trouble with the board, and there's gonna be a criminal case against me, or maybe there already is a criminal case. Well, no, I mean, normally you can't disclose the confidential information that a client gives you. And here too, that if you learn about this attorney misconduct in the course of a representation and it's confidential for that reason, then you're not required to disclose it. All of the states also have an exception for information gained while participating in a lawyer's assistance program. In Minnesota, and I'm guessing probably in Iowa and Wisconsin, there's a lawyers, I think it's called. It's an organization to help attorneys who have, you know, problems with chemical dependency or things like that that are affecting their work. So if you are a counselor and somebody comes in under the auspices of that program and says, you know, I've been dipping into my trust account because of my drinking problem, you are not required to disclose it because that information was gained as part of that program. So it is similar to the attorney-client relationship, although if you're acting as a drug counselor for other attorneys, you're not, that would otherwise be outside the scope of the practice of law. So they built that in there. Iowa makes clear that it has to be an approved program. And I'm not sure who it's approved by, but you can't just say, well, I didn't turn it in because I decided to start my own lawyer assistance program. Well, if you're going to start a program like that, you better get it approved first. And even in other states, if you're going to give that kind of advice, you probably should make sure that you're set up right so that this rule does protect you. And in Wisconsin, I don't know why they put this in, the other states didn't, but if you find information about a violation, if you're an arbitrator or a mediator in a fee dispute between attorneys, I don't know how often that comes up, but two attorneys are going to share a fee in the case, and they can't decide, you know, who gets what percentage of the fee between the two attorneys. Not between an attorney and a client, but between two attorneys. And you are the mediator to decide that. And during the course of the mediation or arbitration, you discover that one of the lawyers violated the rules. Well, they built in an exception that you're not required to turn that one in either. But other than those exceptions, if you see misconduct by another attorney that violates the rules, then you're required to turn them in, and then you are subject to discipline if you fail to do so. So that's the rat on your brain. Rule 8.4 covers miscellaneous things that they did not think of, that didn't fit under one of the other rules. And some of these, as we read through some of these, they vary a lot from state to state. So you can kind of tell when you read these that most of them were probably prompted by some individual case. Where somebody did something and then they looked at the rules and thought it in there, so they decided they had it. Miscellaneous. Well, rule one is if you violate the other rules, or if you knowingly assist a violation, or induce a violation, or commit a violation through another person's act. I think that's all pretty much been covered by the other rules, that you can't help somebody else or you can't have your underlings commit an offense. But this makes clear that you can't assist another lawyer in violating the rules or do anything. It is a violation. So in other words, these things, I mean, you're not supposed to do them anyway, obviously, like number two, commit a crime. But they're put in here because, just to make clear, that you can be disbarred or subject to attorney discipline for doing any of these. So number two, commit a criminal act. But it has to be only certain kinds of criminal acts. You won't necessarily get disbarred for any crime because to get disbarred or suspended or whatever, the criminal act must reflect adversely on your honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. Now, I suspect you can take pretty much almost any crime and put it in one of those categories. Obviously, if you steal something, that's not being honest. So, even though it's not connected with the practice of law, so if you go to Macy's and do some shoplifting or whatever, that reflects on your honesty. You need to be prosecuted or subject to discipline as an attorney for doing that, even though it doesn't relate to the practice of law. Now, I don't know where they stand on things like DWI. I suspect that's probably even more on a case-by-case basis, because maybe that does reflect on your business as a lawyer. So they would probably take a look at that. Because if you're drinking while you're driving, they're gonna think that, well, maybe you're drinking when you're in court too, which might reflect on your fitness as a lawyer. So there are probably some criminal offenses that would not necessarily result in discipline, although I think they would probably take a hard look at them. Number three, it doesn't have to be a crime. It can be any kind of conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. So, again, not necessarily connected with the practice of law, but if you engage in any kind of fraud anywhere, that is a problem. You're not allowed to state or imply an ability to improperly influence a government agency or achieve results that violate the rules or violate the law. So you can't state or imply that come to me because I know where the money has to change hands to influence the judge. You can't state or imply that whether or not it's true. You can't knowingly assist a judicial officer in something that violates the rules of judicial conduct or violates other law. So if the judge asks you to do something that would assist him or her in violating the rules of judicial conduct, then you are subject to the discipline for doing that. So those five are against the rule of all things. You're not allowed to commit crimes and any other commit fraud. Wisconsin has a few. Wisconsin, and this is kind of covered by the other ones, I think. You're not allowed, you're subject to discipline if you violate any statute, a Supreme Court order, or a rule or decision that regulates the conduct of lawyers. I think what they're just getting at is not if they're, sometimes there are separate sets of rules that are promulgated for specific situations. That aren't in the general rules of professional conduct. But if you violate one of those rules, they're kind of incorporated by reference. Violate the attorney's oath. Now, how many of you remember word for word the attorney's oath that you took when you were sworn in? Because remember, you were sworn in, and you took an oath. I thought I was going to include it here. I guess I didn't include it in the material. That oath is found in the Minnesota statutes, in the same section as the oath governing jurors and witnesses. There's the oath for attorneys is in there. And we've covered everything in there. There are no surprises in there. But you have to, you promise to be faithful to your clients and not be dishonest. But in Wisconsin, that's specifically incorporated into these rules. And I think this was covered earlier, but also if you fail to cooperate in any investigation or grievance filed with the Office of Regulating Lawyers. The other case it said that you can't make any false statements or and you have to correct misapprehensions. Wisconsin goes a little bit further and says you shall cooperate. You're required to cooperate, not just tell the truth, not just disclose information, but affirmatively cooperate. So I may have to go a little bit further. In Minnesota and Wisconsin have both adopted the following provision, that you may not harass a person in connection with your professional activity. There are two provisions here about discrimination and harassment. This one in Minnesota and Wisconsin governs your professional activity. So you can't harass people in connection with the practice of law or your law office. You can't harass your employees, you can't harass witnesses, etc., based on sex, race, age, creed, religion, national origin, disability, sexual preference, or marital status. So you're not allowed, in connection with the practice of law, you're not allowed to harass people with regard to those, even if that harassment might otherwise be legal. It's when you're in the practice of law, the rules are a little bit more strict on that. But this rule also goes on to say, because, you know, if you're, in some discrimination based upon one of those things, well, there's a lawyer on the other side. So the rule makes clear that legitimate advocacy regarding those factors is not a violation. So just because you're defending the discrimination lawsuit, you're not necessarily in trouble. But it has to be legitimate advocacy. So you can't cross the line to harassment based upon one of those factors. That's Minnesota and Wisconsin. Iowa and Wisconsin have a couple here. First of all, it's number 11, because that's kind of on the same topic as before. In Iowa and Minnesota, you're not allowed to engage in sexual harassment or unlawful discrimination in the practice of law or knowingly permit your staff or agents to do so. Minnesota also says that you can't violate the general discrimination laws, the federal, state, or local discrimination laws. And I didn't quote that in the material here. Any violation of the rules of any violation of law relating to discrimination is whether or not it's part of the practice of law. So if you discriminate illegally, you know, you own an apartment building in addition to the practice of law, and you discriminate against potential tenants based upon the race, well, you're subject to discipline as an attorney for doing that in Minnesota. Now, Minnesota does have a number of factors talking about how serious the violation is. You know, will you get disbarred or will you get reprimanded for it? And one of the factors is whether or not it's in connection with the practice of law. So that would be, if you discriminate in housing, you might see a mitigating factor a little bit to say, well, that was in housing. I don't discriminate in my law practice. So maybe that would be a little bit of a mitigating factor. But that is still a violation of the rules of professional conduct to discriminate, to violate another discrimination law, even if it's not in the practice of law. And in Iowa and Minnesota, you're not allowed to engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. That's kind of broad, I would say. So in other words, I think they're kind of saying, if we forgot something else on this list, we're going to include it. And Minnesota, number 12, and I'm guessing this probably came out of one particular case, refused to honor a final and binding arbitration award after agreeing to arbitrate a fee dispute. So your client comes in and says, you have a fee dispute, and say, well, let's go into binding arbitration. I agree to be bound. If you refuse to honor that, you're subject to discipline for that. In addition to probably, having an enforcement against you. So just the refusal is subject to discipline. Choice of law, just real quickly. So disciplinary authority. If you're admitted in one state, you're subject to discipline in that state. So if you're admitted in Minnesota, you're subject to discipline in Minnesota, even if you committed the offense in another state. If you are not admitted in this state, you still might be subject to that state's disciplinary authority if you offer to provide any legal services in the state. So when I'm admitted in Minnesota and I go down to Iowa and I say, I will go to court in Iowa for you. I'm offering to provide legal services in that state, so I'm subject to jurisdiction by the Iowa Board of Lawyer Regulation. And the rule makes clear, in all the states, makes clear that you can be subject to the rule of more than one state. On a choice of law, the law is pretty much the same on all these in most states, so this probably doesn't come up too often, other than like those advertising things, but there are differences. If you do something in connection with a case before a court, then you're subject to the location where that is. So if you're admitted in Minnesota and you're maybe admitted pro hac vice in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin law would apply, whether or not you get disbarred for doing that. For other conduct, if you're only admitted in one state, then the rules of your home state govern. If you're admitted in more than one state, so if you're admitted in Minnesota and Iowa, then the primary one is the state where your principal practice is. But if it has an effect in another jurisdiction, then the rules of that jurisdiction would apply. Well, for those of you who have been here for three sessions, you are now, your ethics are now covered for another 3 years. We've gotten through 3 hours of it, and that brings us to the end of hour number six. And I did not say any key code words, so I'll have to come up with some questions for that. But are there any questions from the audience? Okay, well, for any podcast listeners, if you do have any questions, please email them to me, clem.law@usa.net. I'll answer within the time allowed by the rules. And thank you very much for coming.